She was found hanging, naked, bound, and silenced. The official story? Suicide. But the truth? It's buried beneath red paint, twisted rope, and a powerful family desperate to protect its image. Told in a chilling first-person voice from beyond the grave, this is Rebecca's story, the screams they ignored, the evidence they erased, and the justice that almost never came. This isn't just a true crime case, it's a haunting reckoning. Welcome to the Mansion Hanging Mystery. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Mansion Hanging Mystery. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Fall Before the Fall. You ever walk into a room that looks like paradise but feels like a damn cage? That's what it felt like the first time I stepped into the Spreckles Mansion. Massive, white-trimmed with deep navy shutters, a Mediterranean beast of a house nestled against the cliffs in Coronado, San Diego County. 30-something rooms, I think. One of those places where even the air smells expensive. But no amount of sea breeze could scrub away the feeling that this place wasn't just haunted, it was alive and watching me. I had no business being there, not really. I wasn't born into money. Hell, I was barely surviving paycheck to paycheck until I met Jonah. He was polished, powerful, the kind of man who didn't ask for things, he expected them. He had this quiet, cold elegance that made me feel like I was constantly auditioning just to stay in his life. And when he invited me to stay at his mansion with his family for the summer, I should have said no. But I didn't, because I wanted to believe this was the start of something permanent. Real. Maybe even a family. And God help me, I wanted to prove I could belong in his world, no matter how many people in it looked at me like I was just a phase he'd outgrow. It was the summer of 2011. The kind of California summer where the sun felt like it could bleach your memories clean if you stood in it long enough. Jonah's son Max, 6 years old, curious, and way too bright for his age, had been staying with us. He had these big, soulful eyes, always asking questions. Why is the sky blue? Do people live in the moon? Innocent stuff. The kind of stuff that breaks your heart later, because it reminds you how fragile childhood is. The accident happened fast. Too fast. I was in the bathroom, maybe 10-15 feet away, when I heard the crash. A sickening thud, followed by silence. That kind of silence that grabs your spine and drags you forward before your brain can catch up. I ran out and found him. Max, face down at the bottom of the stairs, the chandelier still swaying above like a pendulum counting down seconds I couldn't stop. I screamed. I remember screaming so loud my voice cracked open. His scooter was there, turned on its side, helmet nowhere in sight. His tiny body twisted in a way that made me want to throw up. There was blood. A little, but enough. His eyes were open but unfocused, like he was looking right through me. I called 911, hands shaking so bad I could barely hit the buttons. The dispatcher's voice was calm, methodical, but my mind was splitting. CPR. Mouth to mouth. Chest compressions. I did everything they said. I did everything I could. But something in me already knew, we were losing him. And it was my fault. They flew him out in a chopper. Jonah was at the airport at the time, headed on a business trip. I called him in hysterics. Told him everything. When he got back, his face didn't twist into rage or panic. It froze, like a man watching his empire collapse from the inside, but refusing to let the outside world see. He didn't say it was my fault. He didn't have to. It was there in every glance that lingered too long and every word left unspoken. The house changed after that. I swear to God, it felt like the walls were breathing. Every time I passed the stairs, I felt Max's fall replaying in my head. Over and over. Every squeak of the banister, every echo off the marble tiles became a fucking soundtrack to guilt. Jonah's brother, Adam, flew in from Tennessee soon after. Big guy. Broad shoulders. That quiet type that always looks like he's thinking 10 things he'll never say out loud. We'd only met a handful of times, and even then, I never got a good read on him. He wasn't cruel, but he had this off-putting intensity, like a coiled spring you're not sure is broken, or just waiting to snap. He said he came to support the family during the crisis. I didn't argue, but the way he looked at me, not just judgment, something deeper, like he was dissecting me from the inside out, watching the way I moved, the way I spoke. And I swear, sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night and feel like I wasn't alone in the room. Jonah and I stopped sleeping in the same bed. He said he needed time. He was barely home anyway, back and forth to the hospital, to meetings, to wherever rich men go when they need to pretend nothing's falling apart. That left me in the house. Alone. Except I wasn't. There were whispers, low murmurs behind closed doors. Doors that creaked open when I swore I'd locked them. Lights flickering, the security system going off without cause. I told myself it was just the stress, the grief, the trauma. But then I started finding things. My phone in a different place than I left it. A towel in my bathroom I didn't use. A glass in the sink, filled with water I didn't pour. Stupid shit, but you start to feel like you're going crazy. One night I came downstairs and found Adam in the kitchen. It was around 2 a.m. I hadn't been able to sleep. He was just standing there in the dark, shirtless, barefoot, staring out the window at the ocean. I asked if he was okay. He didn't answer. Just looked at me for a long moment, then smiled, small, cold, and wrong. "You believe in karma, Rebecca?" he asked. I froze. "What? Karma?" he repeated. "The idea that we all get what we deserve eventually." I didn't answer. I just backed out of the kitchen and went upstairs, locked the door, and cried myself to sleep. And then, just when I thought it couldn't get worse, Jonah told me Max wasn't going to make it. They were pulling life support. I shattered. I didn't sleep that night. I barely breathed. The weight in my chest felt like it was crushing my lungs. I walked the halls of that mansion like a ghost, trailing my fingers along cold marble and whispering apologies into rooms with no one in them. Apologies to Max, to God, to anyone who might be listening. And when I opened my eyes the next morning, I knew something had shifted. The air was thicker, the silence deeper, and I swear I felt it in my bones. Something was coming, and it wasn't just grief. Chapter 2, Bound in Silence. The day after Max's life support was removed, the mansion felt like it was holding its breath. You know that feeling when a storm is about to break, but everything around you is unnaturally still? That's what it felt like. The ocean outside looked calm, deceptively peaceful. But inside the Spreckles mansion, the air was thick with a kind of tension you could chew through. Like grief had its own gravitational pull, dragging everything inward. People spoke in half sentences. Nobody made eye contact for long. Everyone was just surviving the hours. I remember sitting at the edge of the guest room bed, staring at the floor for so long I forgot my legs had fallen asleep beneath me. The hardwood beneath my feet was ice cold, like the house was rejecting my presence one nerve ending at a time. I hadn't eaten in 24 hours. Maybe more. There was food in the fridge, I knew that, but every time I opened the door, my stomach twisted in protest. That morning, I heard Jonah crying for the first time. Not a sob, not loud, just this broken sound leaking from behind the bathroom door down the hall. The kind of sound a man makes when he's trying not to fall apart, but knows it's already too late. I wanted to go to him, to hold him, but something stopped me. I think a part of him blamed me. And honestly, I blamed myself too. Max had been under my care. I should have heard the scooter sooner. I should have insisted he wear his helmet. I should have been faster. I should have been better. And now this tiny, brilliant soul was gone because I wasn't. The guilt gnawed at me like termites in my spine. I wandered the halls that day like a zombie. There were so many damn rooms in that place. Rooms nobody even used. Long corridors with antique furniture and framed oil paintings staring down at me like they knew something I didn't. A hallway lined with old black and white photographs of the original Spreckles family. Men in suits, women in corsets, children standing so still they looked embalmed. It felt like they were judging me from the grave. And then there was that door. The one at the end of the East Wing hallway. The one I always avoided. It had no reason to be creepy. Just a plain, white door with an old brass handle. But something about it felt wrong. Like it hummed at a different frequency than the rest of the house. I used to catch myself glancing at it without meaning to, like my subconscious was warning me. Stay away. That afternoon I walked past it again, and this time it was cracked open. Barely, just an inch, but enough to see that it wasn't empty inside. There was a light on. I should have kept walking. I know that now, but something pulled me in. The room inside was mostly bare. Old wooden floorboards. A covered mirror leaned against the far wall, half draped in dusty cloth. There was a small desk in the corner, scratched and stained, like it had survived a fire or a fight. And on top of it, something strange. A notebook. One of those cheap spiral-bound ones, edges frayed and cover bent like it had been flipped through hundreds of times. I shouldn't have touched it, but I did. When I opened it, I found pages and pages of handwriting, blocky, rushed, written in all caps. Lists. Schedules. Observations. It was like someone had been keeping tabs on everything happening in the house. Some of the entries mentioned me. Our left light's on again. Wasting electricity. Always careless. are outside at 1:37 a.m. pacing. Our talks to herself when alone. Possible instability. My throat closed up. My ears started to ring. Who the fuck had been watching me? I slammed the notebook shut, heart jackhammering in my chest. I backed out of the room, pulled the door closed behind me and ran. I didn't tell anyone about it. Not Jonah. Not Adam. Who would believe me? I was already being treated like a fragile thing barely holding herself together. I didn't need anyone thinking I was seeing ghosts or spinning conspiracies. But I knew someone in that house had been watching, recording, studying me like a specimen in a jar. That night, I couldn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw Max's tiny body at the bottom of the stairs. His wide, unblinking eyes. His small, bloody lips. The shrill echo of the sirens. I got up around midnight and went downstairs to make tea. The house was dead silent. Not even the usual groans of the wood or hum of the fridge. Just stillness. As I passed the living room, I noticed something. The door to the backyard, the one leading to the courtyard, was open. I swear on my life I'd locked it earlier. I stepped outside, bare feet brushing against the cold tile. The moon was high, casting the whole mansion in silver. Everything looked washed out, surreal, like a dream. I turned toward the balcony, the one off the bedroom where I was staying. That's when I saw it. Paint. Red. A thick, jagged message scrawled across the door, just above eye level. She saved him, can you save her? I stopped breathing. The paint looked fresh. It was still dripping. I stumbled backward, fell to my knees in the grass. My brain scrambled for meaning. Was this a threat? A confession? A sick joke? Then I heard the creak. From upstairs. I looked up, toward the balcony, and saw a shadow moving across the railing. A figure. Someone was up there. Watching me. I ran inside. Locked every door. Double-checked the windows. Called out for Jonah, no answer. Called for Adam, silence. I didn't sleep. I sat on the floor of my bedroom, back against the door, a kitchen knife in my lap. I didn't even realize I was crying until I felt the tears soak through my shirt. This wasn't grief anymore. This was fear. Real, animal, bone-deep fear. Someone was trying to break me. Slowly. Methodically. And no one believed me because everyone thought I was already broken. I thought about leaving. I really did. But guilt is a funny thing. It tethers you to the place where everything went wrong. It whispers lies in your ear. You deserve this. You brought this on yourself. You can't run from the truth. And besides, where the hell was I supposed to go? By sunrise, I'd made a decision. I wasn't going to leave. I was going to stay. And find out what the fuck was really going on. Even if it killed me. Chapter 3, The Balcony. You ever feel like your own mind is turned against you? That night, I wasn't sure what was more dangerous. The people in the house or the storm building inside my skull. It started with a whisper. Just one. A single breath of sound that didn't belong to me. At first, I thought it was the wind. The Spreckles mansion sat so close to the ocean that the breeze sometimes sang through cracks in the windows like a sad violin. But this was different. It wasn't the moan of air or the groan of wood. It was syllables. Words. My name. Rebecca. Soft. Inhaled more than spoken. I sat up in bed, heart pounding in my chest. The digital clock on the nightstand glared back at me. 3:06 a.m. Classic witching hour. The room was dim, lit only by the glow from the hallway nightlight that bled beneath the door. I scanned the space. Nothing moved. Nothing spoke. Just the steady tick of the grandfather clock down the hall, slicing the night into heartbeats. But I wasn't crazy. I hadn't imagined it. I knew what I heard. I got up, grabbed the flashlight I kept beside the bed. Ever since the paint on the door, I'd been keeping it close. My hand trembled as I clicked it on and moved toward the door. I pressed my ear to the wood. Silence. I cracked the door open. The hallway was empty, bathed in that sickly amber glow that makes everything look like an old photograph. I stepped out, barefoot, flashlight trembling in my grip. Down the hallway. Past the family portraits. Past the staircase. Past the room where Max fell. The air was thicker there. Like the walls hadn't forgotten. I made my way to the second floor landing and turned toward the east wing. Toward the balcony. I didn't know why. Something pulled me. When I reached the French doors leading out, I paused. The handle was warm. That shouldn't have been possible. It was a chilly night. The coastal air had a bite to it, even in July. But that brass handle felt like it had just been gripped by someone else. I pushed the door open. The wind hit me immediately, salty and sharp, slapping strands of hair across my face. The balcony stretched out before me like a stage. The same balcony where my body would later be found, dangling like some sick art installation. But I didn't know that yet. All I knew was that something felt wrong. Deeply, fundamentally wrong. I stepped out. My bare feet hit the cold tile. The flashlight flickered. Out here, the world was too quiet. No birds. No waves. Just a low electrical hum, maybe from the house. Maybe from my brain short-circuiting. And then I saw it. On the floor. A length of rope. It was coiled in a perfect circle. Like someone had set it there deliberately. Waiting. Watching. Daring me to ask why. My stomach turned. I backed up. The flashlight went out. Suddenly, I wasn't alone. I didn't hear the footsteps. I didn't see the movement. But I felt it, like static crawling over my skin. Like the moment right before a lightning strike. I spun around, hard in my throat, and screamed. Someone was standing in the doorway. A silhouette. Male. Broad shoulders. Still, I couldn't see his face. The light from the hallway was too dim, too warped by my panic. "Who the fuck are you?" I shouted. No answer. "Jonah," I asked. "Adam." Still silence. The figure stepped forward. Just one step. Just enough for me to see the edge of his mouth, smirking. And then he raised something. A rag. White. Soaked. I turned to run, but the arms were already on me, wrapping, grabbing, yanking me back inside. The balcony vanished behind me. My flashlight fell with a clatter. The cloth came over my mouth. I kicked. Fought. Screamed. But the world went soft. Black. Like ink spilled in water. When I came to, I was naked. Bound. Lying face down on the bed in the guest room. My arms were tied behind me, wrists pinched with what felt like rope or cord. My ankles were bound, too. Tight enough that circulation was a suggestion. My mouth was dry. My throat burned. My head throbbed. I tried to scream, but all that came out was a strangled rasp. Footsteps. Behind me. Slow. Deliberate. Tears welled up in my eyes before I even saw him. And then he spoke. "You shouldn't have opened that notebook, Rebecca." His voice. I knew that voice. "Adam." He stepped into my field of view, calm as a priest, holding a red paintbrush dripping with fresh liquid. "Paint? Blood?" He smiled down at me. "You really don't get it, do you?" I shook my head, panic clouding everything. "Please," I whispered. It was supposed to be simple. A suicide. Clean. Sympathetic. But then you started snooping. Started asking questions. He walked to the wall. Started painting. "She saved him, can you save her?" The same message from the courtyard. "What does that even mean?" I croaked. He paused, cocked his head. "Symbolism," he said. "They love that shit on TV. Makes the whole thing seem deep. Poetic." "You're sick," I hissed. He crouched next to me, grabbing my chin. "You know what's sick, Rebecca? Covering for someone your whole life. Cleaning up their messes. Protecting a reputation that's built on bullshit. My brother has ruined more lives than you know. But the moment Max got hurt, you became the scapegoat. He let go. I'm just giving them what they want. Closure. You get to be the tragic girlfriend who couldn't take the guilt. Jonah gets to move on. The public gets a headline." He stood up. Walked to the bed. "I'm gonna help you now, Rebecca. I'm gonna help you do what you were already thinking about." "No. Please. No." He tied the noose himself. I saw it. Felt it. The fibers dragging across my skin. And then everything blurred again. Pain. Pressure. Movement. I was no longer in control of my body. Hands lifting me. A scream swallowed by a throat that couldn't make sound. And then. Air. Cold. Wide open space. The edge of the balcony. His voice in my ear. "Don't worry, they'll believe it. They always believe the simple version." And then, nothing. I don't remember falling. I remember being weightless, being rage, being grief. And when I finally opened my eyes again, it was like watching the world through a veil. My body was still hanging, nude, bound, on display, but I was no longer in it. I was floating above, screaming, but no sound came out. Watching the morning light hit my skin. Watching Adam discover me and fake a gasp. Watching the police come and shrug. Watching the headlines write themselves. Woman driven to suicide after tragic accident. Boyfriend's girlfriend found hanging at Spreckles Mansion. No signs of foul play. Are you fucking kidding me? I was murdered. I was bound. Gagged. Painted on like a canvas. And no one did a damn thing. Chapter 4, Dead Woman Hanging. You don't notice the exact moment you die. There's no switch. No thunderclap. No bright tunnel or angelic chorus. 1 minute, you're tethered to pain, screaming through your last breath, begging the world to stop. The next, silence. The kind of silence that feels infinite, thick, final. I didn't fall. I was dropped, like waste, like a problem solved. The rope burned against my neck. The air was stolen from my lungs. My limbs kicked, struggled, then surrendered. And then it was over. But I was still here. Not in my body. No, that had become something else entirely. A thing. A display. A grotesque centerpiece on the balcony of a mansion that had already swallowed too many secrets. I hovered just above it, still aware, still me, but detached. Like someone had taken a hot knife and split my soul down the middle. One half hanging lifeless. The other hovering unseen, unheard, but wide awake. The dawn came slowly, peeling away the night with cruel indifference. The sky turned pale pink. Gulls cried out over the coast. The ocean shimmered. It was beautiful. It was horrifying. Because there I was. Naked. Bound. Hanging from the balcony rail like a condemned witch from a twisted fairy tale. My hair twisted in the breeze. My body swayed gently like wind chimes on a porch. And below me, the house began to stir. Adam was the first to step outside. Of course he was. He always knew how to play a role. Grief-stricken hero. Shocked witness. Dutiful brother. He had it all rehearsed. He came out barefoot, shirtless, holding his phone like he'd just woken up for a morning jog. His expression was one part horror, two parts performance. He gasped, just loud enough for the security camera to catch it. Then he called 911. His voice trembled perfectly. There's a girl, she's hanging. She's dead. Oh God. She's not breathing. No mention of the ropes. Of the red message on the door. No panic about fingerprints. No, I touched her trying to revive her. Just carefully controlled chaos. The dispatcher stayed calm. They always do. Sir, is the person conscious? No. She's naked. Tied up. I don't know what the hell happened. But he did know. He knew exactly what happened. The cops showed up within minutes. Lights flashing. Radios chirping. Guns holstered but ready. They moved through the property with the clinical detachment of men who've already decided what happened before they got out of the car. They stood beneath me, craning their necks. One of them, Sergeant Fields, I think, squinted up and said, That's some weird suicide. Another laughed under his breath. Kinky. I wanted to scream. I wanted to descend like fire and wrath and make them see. This wasn't suicide. It wasn't a fetish gone wrong. It wasn't a goddamn accident. I was murdered. Methodically. Quietly. And now erased. Inside, Jonah had no idea yet. He was still asleep in his suite on the other side of the house. When they knocked on his door, he opened it slowly, face puffy, eyes bloodshot. He looked like a man who'd barely slept in days, because he hadn't. He was grieving. Drowning. Mr. Shacknai, I'm afraid, there's been an incident. He blinked. What? It's Rebecca. We found her outside. She appears to have taken her own life. That word. Appears. So soft. So careful. Jonah didn't react at first. Just blinked. Like he was trying to reboot his brain. And then slowly, the walls collapsed around him. I watched him crumble in on himself. His mouth fell open, and a sound came out that I will never forget. Not a scream. Not a cry. It was somewhere between a growl and a sob. A broken animal. A man finally destroyed. And still, he didn't ask the right questions. No one did. Not yet. The scene was staged. The message, "She saved him, can you save her?" was noted by forensics, photographed, and dismissed. They called it a possible emotional expression. A suicide note in code. Artistic despair. They didn't ask why it was painted at eye level. Why it was written in block caps. Why the paintbrush was left deliberately on the floor, like some sick afterthought. They tested for fingerprints, but not Adam's. They found blood on the handle, but chalked it up to transfer from my own body. They noted the bindings, wrists and ankles tied behind me, in an impossible configuration. The kind of knot that required multiple steps, tension, strength. The kind of thing a person doesn't do alone. But they still said it was suicide. Because to believe anything else would have been too messy. Too dangerous. Too inconvenient. The coroner's report came days later. They called it ligature hanging. Said the bruising was consistent with self-inflicted suspension. Ignored the blunt force trauma on the back of my skull. Dismissed the signs of restraint around my ankles. Overlooked the hemorrhaging in my throat, the defensive wounds, the scrapes on my knees, the fragments of skin under my fingernails. They labeled me emotionally distressed. Blamed guilt over Max's accident. Blamed grief. Womanhood. Fragility. Melancholy. The media picked it up fast. Suicide in Coronado Mansion. Tragic end to a grieving girlfriend. She just couldn't live with herself. I wanted to reach through the pages, through the cameras, through the glass and wires and ink and shake them all. No, that wasn't the story. That wasn't the fucking truth. My family came in from Missouri. They flew across the country, already devastated from the news, only to be handed a sanitized version of my death, wrapped in ribbons and red tape. They didn't buy it. Not for a second. My sister Mary was the first to start screaming. At detectives. At reporters. At anyone who would listen. She didn't kill herself. She wouldn't do that. Rebecca was scared. She told me something was wrong. But nobody listened to angry women. Not ones without money. Not ones without power. The whispers started. That I was unstable. That I had a history of depression. I didn't. That I was obsessed with Jonah. That I wanted to die in his house to make a statement. That I enjoyed the drama. That I was seeking attention, even in death. Every day, the truth was buried deeper. And I couldn't do a damn thing about it. I was stuck. Trapped. A ghost in the place where I was erased. I started to notice something strange, though. As time passed, days, weeks, the air inside the mansion began to change. Jonah wouldn't sleep in that house anymore. Adam left town. But I stayed. Because I had nowhere else to go. And maybe, just maybe, my anger was starting to echo. Lights flickered in rooms they shouldn't. Doors opened on their own. The smell of paint lingered, even when nothing had been touched. The walls creaked with whispers. Sometimes, people said they felt me. Not all of them, but a few. The housekeeper quit. Said she saw me in the mirror, standing behind her. Said she heard footsteps upstairs when no one was home. Said she felt her hair move like someone had passed too close. They called her crazy. Just like they called me crazy. But I wasn't crazy. I was murdered. And somewhere deep inside this house, it still remembers. Chapter 5, Verdict in the Void. They say the dead can't feel time. But they're wrong. Time is all I feel. It's the way it stretches like molasses through the cracks of memory. How it curls around my ankles and drags me through the same 24 hours over and over again. The night I died, the morning I was found, the moment they all looked at my body and lied. Time didn't free me. It imprisoned me. And in that prison I watched. I watched the world forget me. I watched the headlines fade. I watched Jonah move on. I watched Adam disappear. And I watched my family try to pick up the pieces of a puzzle no one else wanted to solve. My sister Mary became the fire I couldn't be. She didn't sit in silence. She didn't swallow the narrative fed to her by men in suits with polished badges and tighter alibis. She raised hell. She took to every podcast, every local news segment, every courtroom step she could reach. Her voice cracked in interviews. Her hands trembled behind podiums. But she never stopped saying the truth. My sister didn't tie herself up. My sister didn't paint that message. My sister didn't commit suicide. Rebecca was murdered. And people started to listen. Not the people who mattered. Not yet, but enough to make the others uncomfortable. Detectives closed their blinds when she showed up at the station. Jonah's PR team sent cease and desist letters. Adam, he vanished entirely. But my family didn't back down. They filed a civil suit. Because if the law wouldn't call it what it was, then at least the truth might. I remember the day it went to trial. I watched from somewhere above or inside or beyond. It's hard to define the geography of the afterlife. It's not heaven. It's not hell. It's just presence. A place between rage and memory. The courtroom was cold. Lit like a morgue. Rows of strangers with pressed jackets and bored eyes. And in the middle of it all, Mary. Standing alone in front of a wall of money and power and polished manipulation. She told them everything. Every voicemail I left her. Every tearful call where I whispered I didn't feel safe. Every gut instinct that told her something wasn't right. The prosecution presented the evidence the cops had ignored. The bindings. The impossibility of self-tying. The red paint. The location of bruises. The lack of fingerprints. The absurdity of the narrative. They showed photos of my body. I couldn't look. They read my text messages aloud. I wanted to scream. They dissected my final hours like surgeons carving up a corpse. And through it all, I saw Jonah in the corner. Tight-jawed. Pale. Sweating. He never looked up. Adam was forced to testify. He sat there, stiff as stone, avoiding eye contact. Every answer rehearsed. Every shrug a dagger. Every, I don't recall, a nail in the coffin of truth. And then, the verdict. It didn't come fast. It came after weeks of testimony, speculation, and smears. But it came. We, the jury, find the defendant, Adam Shacknai, responsible for the wrongful death of Rebecca Zahau. The words didn't bring me back. But they rippled through the void like thunder. My mother cried so hard she collapsed in her seat. Mary clutched the photo of me that she'd carried every single day for 7 years. And Adam? He blinked. He didn't flinch. Didn't cry. Just blinked. Like someone whose soul was so fractured he no longer understood consequences. The judge awarded my family $5 million in damages. Not because I was worth that amount, but because that's how this world calculates pain. Still, the criminal justice system didn't budge. The sheriff's office refused to reopen the investigation. Even after the verdict, even after the evidence, even after a jury said, this wasn't a suicide, they stood by their ruling, said it didn't meet the threshold for murder, said it was tragic, yes, complicated, sure, but ultimately a choice I made. They didn't see the bruises as binding marks. They didn't question the positioning of the ropes. They didn't ask how a woman ties her hands behind her back, her feet, her neck, then leaps. They didn't want to ask, because the truth threatened everything. But I wasn't silent anymore. I started to feel different, lighter maybe, like the verdict had untied some of the ropes still holding me here. I began to dream again, not just of the night I died, but of my life. The one before Jonah, before Spreckles, before the eyes that watched me from behind locked doors. I saw my childhood, the little Missouri house with creaky floors and a kitchen that always smelled like cinnamon. I saw Mary and me, curled up under blankets, whispering secrets past bedtime. I saw the first time I fell in love, the first time I got my heart broken, the first time I forgave someone who didn't deserve it. And I realized, I wasn't just a victim. I was me. I had lived. I had laughed. I had been brave. And even though the world chose to remember me for how I died, I chose to remember how I lived. That was my final rebellion. Years passed. The media moved on. The mansion sold. Again, new paint, new furniture, same ghosts. I watched as tourists stood at the gate and whispered about the hanging girl. I watched as podcasters profited off my story. I watched as strangers debated my sanity like it was up for auction. But I also watched others, quiet people, kind people, fight for girls like me. Activists, journalists, survivors, people who demanded better, who refused to let women be erased behind locked doors and pretty houses and powerful men. They said my name. They said it right. And that meant something. I don't know when I'll leave this place. Maybe I already have, in pieces. Maybe I never will. But I do know this. If you're listening to this story, if you've made it this far, then I'm still here. In your ears. In your spine. In your breath when you walk past the edge of comfort and into fear. Because I want you to remember what they tried to bury. I didn't jump. I didn't run. I didn't break. I was taken. I was silenced. And even in death, I will not be quiet.